Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
I dreamed, Mr. Doty says, the night after the fall planting, that a bird who loved me had been long neglected. And when I took it from the closet and gave it water, its tongue began to move again, and it began to beat the lush green music of its wings and wrapped the brilliant risk of leaves all round my face. It seems that I have made him give his own introduction. Whether or no, let him now speak for himself. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mark Doty.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to thank the Poetry Center for bringing me to Chicago, and especially for giving me the opportunity to feel more like Loretta Young than I have ever felt in my life, emerging from behind the curtains. I'm going to go back and forth between some poems from my Alexandria and some work from a forthcoming book, Atlantis, which will be out next fall. And I want to begin with a poem which has to do, in part, with a poet's gratitude for having an audience, for feeling heard. How's the sound level here? Okay, in the back? It's a long ways up there. It's hard for me to tell. This poem is set in New York City. It refers to that glorious vault over Grand Central Station with its decoration of constellations. In these patterns of the constellations, there are electric lights which represent the stars. And because it's New York City, at least five of these lights actually work. Right. Now, that is mentioned here. The poem is called Broadway. Under Grand Central's tattered vault, maybe half a dozen electric stars still lit, one saxophone blew, and a sheer black scrim billowed over some minor constellation under repair. Then, on Broadway, red wings in a storefront tableau, lustrous, the live macaws preening, beaks opening and closing like those animated knives that unfold all night in jewelers' windows. For sale, glass eyes turned out toward the rain, the birds lined up like the endless flowers and cheap gems, the makeshift tables of secondhand magazines and shoes the hawker's eye, while they shelter in the doorways of banks. So many pockets and paper cups and hands reeled over the weight of that glittered pavement. And at 103rd, a woman reached to me across the wet roof of a stranger's car and said, "I'm Carlotta. I'm hungry." She was only asking for change, so I don't know why I took her hand. The rooftops were glowing above us, enormous, crystalline, a second city lit from within. That night, a man on the downtown local stood up and said, "My name is Ezekiel. I am a poet, and my poem this evening is called Fall." He stood up straight to recite, a child reminded of his posture by the gravity of his text, his hands hidden in the pocket of his coat. "Love is protected," he said, "the way leaves are packed in snow, the rubies of fall. God is protecting the jewel of love for us." He didn't ask for anything, but I gave him the change left in my pocket, and the man beside me, impulsive, moved, gave Ezekiel his watch. It wasn't an expensive watch. I don't even know if it worked. But the poet started, then walked away, as if so much good fortune must be hurried away from before anyone realizes it's a mistake. Carlotta, her stocking cap glazed like feathers in the rain, under the radiant towers, the floodlit ramparts, must have wondered at my impulse to touch her, which was like touching myself, the way your own hand feels when you hold it because you want to feel contained. She said, "You get home safe now. You hear?" In the same way, Ezekiel turned back to the benevolent stranger. "I will write a poem for you tomorrow," he said. "The poem I will write will go like this. Our ancestors are replenishing the jewel of love for us." Well, as you can tell, I now no longer touch my hand because I want to feel something familiar, but there's this alien object here. I wish that there was a very good story to tell you about this broken wrist. I stepped out of a shower onto a wet floor. Yes. Sure. Yeah, please wave at me if my voice sinks. I want to read you a poem which has to do with language itself, with its projects and possibilities, and also with some non-human residents of my neighborhood. I live in Provincetown, Massachusetts, at the very end of Cape Cod, and I live about half a block from the bay. I found myself one day wrestling with a poem which would not come right, no matter what I did. And to get away from this monster, I walked down to the beach and encountered the marine citizens here described. When I returned to my desk, I found that they had taken over the poem that I intended to write. Now I don't remember what that poem was. This is the result. It's called Difference. The jellyfish float in the bay shallows like schools of clouds. A dozen identical, is it right to call them creatures? These elaborate sacks of nothing? All they seem is shape and shifting. And though a whole troop of undulant cousins go about their business within a single wave's span, every one does something unlike. This one, a balloon, open on both ends, but swollen to its full expanse. This one, a breathing heart. This, a pulsing flower. This one, a rolled condom, or a plastic purse swallowing itself. That one, a Tiffany shade. This, a troubled parasol. This submarine opera's all subterfuge and disguise. Its plot, a fabulous tangle of hiding and recognition. Nothing but trope. Nothing but something forming itself into figures, then refiguring, sheer ectoplasm, recognizable only as the stuff of metaphor. What can words do but link what we know to what we don't, and so form a shape which shrinks or swells, configures or collapses, blooms even as it is described into some unlikely marine chiffon. A gown for Isadora? Nothing but style. What binds one shape to another also sets them apart. But what's lovelier than the shape-shifting of light as? Clear, undulant words. We look at alien grace, unfettered by any fixed form, and we say, balloon, flower, heart, condom, opera, lampshade. parasol, ballet. Hear how the mouth, so full of longing for the world, changes its shape. I'd like to read you one other poem, which also grows out of an encounter with a marine creature. This landscape, the world of coastal New England, has become for me an extraordinary metaphoric resource, treasure house of possibility. This poem describes the remains of a little creature called a green crab. They're usually quite small. A green crab's shell. Not exactly green. Closer to bronze, preserved in kind brine. Something retrieved from a Greco-Roman wreck. Patinated and oddly muscular. We cannot know what his fantastic legs were like, though evidence suggests 8 complexly folded, scuttling works of armament, crowned by the foreclaws' gesture of menace and power. A gull's gobbled the center, leaving this chamber, size of a demitas, open to reveal a shocking Giotto blue. Though it smells of seaweed and ruin, this little traveling case comes with such lavish lining. Imagine breathing surrounded by the brilliant rinse of summer's firmament. What color is the underside of skin? Not so bad to die. If we could be opened into this, if the smallest chambers of ourselves similarly revealed some sky. I want to read this evening a few poems which have to do with lives scoured and transformed by the AIDS epidemic. As in any terrible situation, sometimes the transformations which come about can be startlingly positive ones, as well as terrible ones. This poem has to do with a friend of mine who was comfortably retired. She spent her time writing some poems and doing some bird watching. And she decided that she would be interested in being a volunteer, being a buddy for a person with AIDS. So she started visiting this guy once a week, and soon she was going 3 times a week, and then every day. And when he died, she became a buddy for someone else, and this went on for a while, and she is now the director of volunteer training for the Rhode Island AIDS Project. A life which has taken on an entirely different kind of meaning. So this is one of her stories. The poem's called Brilliance. Maggie's taking care of a man who's dying. He's attended to everything, said goodbye to his parents, paid off his credit card. She says, why don't you just run it up to the limit? But he wants everything squared away. No balance owed, though he misses the pets he's already found a home for. He can't be around dogs or cats, too much risk. He says, I can't have anything. She says, a bowl of goldfish? He says he doesn't want to start with anything, and then describes the kind he'd maybe like, how their tails would fan to a gold flaring. They talk about hot jewel tones, gold lacquer, say maybe they'll go pick some out, though he can't go much of anywhere. And then abruptly he says, I can't love anything, I can't finish. He says it like he's had enough of the whole scintillant world. Though what he means is he'll never be satisfied, and therefore has established this discipline, a kind of severe rehearsal. That's where they leave it, him looking out the window, her knitting as she does because she needs to do something. Later, he leaves a message. Yes, to the bowl of goldfish. Meaning, let me go, if I have to, in brilliance. In a story I read, a Zen master who'd perfected his detachment from the things of the world remembered, at the moment of dying, a deer he used to feed in the park and wondered who might care for it, and was, at that instant, reborn in the stunned flesh of a fawn. So, Maggie's friend, is he going out into the last loved object of his attention, fanning the veined translucence of an opulent tail, undulant in some uncapturable curve? Is he bronze chrysanthemums, copper leaf, hurried darting, doubloons, icon-colored fins troubling the water? Now, this next poem is going to feel like a radical change of tone, but I want to read it now in order to introduce you to a character who will reappear in another poem in a few minutes. I got an invitation to contribute a poem to a new anthology called Unleashed. And the one requirement for this book was that all the poems would be in the voice of the poet's dog. And that, okay, that's a really nice idea for an anthology, and I would never, ever write a poem like that. And about a week later, I was walking in the woods with my dog, Bo, and he began to channel this sonnet. I did not at all expect that he would be a formalist. It seemed completely out of character, but there he went. He likes puns, too. His poem is called Golden Retrievals. Fetch, balls and sticks capture my attention seconds at a time. Catch? I don't think so. Bunny, tumbling leaf, a squirrel who's, oh joy, actually scared. Sniff the wind, then I'm off again. Muck, pond, ditch, residue of any thrillingly dead thing. And you? Either you're sunk in the past, half our walk, thinking of what you never can bring back, or else you're off in some fog concerning tomorrow. Is that what you call it? My work, to unsnare time's warp and woof, retrieving my haze-headed friend, you. This shining bark, a Zen master's bronzy gong, calls you here, entirely, now. Bow wow, bow wow, bow wow. So I send Bo's poem off to the editor of this anthology, who lets me know that she likes it and sends me some of the other poems included in this book, which are wonderful. There's a very sexy poem spoken by Tom Gunn's dog as she pees on a fire hydrant. There's a beautiful elegy, a self-elegy spoken by Maxine Kuman's dog from the grave. And they also let me know that they're sending a photographer from New York to Provincetown to photograph the author of the poem. So the quintessential New York photographer appears in front of my house, all in black, girlfriend all in black. They set up the reflectors, the lights, they pose my dog in front of the house. He was completely into it. Had he had a pipe and a tweed jacket, you know, he would have been complete. So watch for this book. It really is going to be terrific. It'll be out sometime this spring. Well, Bo appears in what I want to read to you next as well. These are three short sections from the title sequence of this new book. The book and the sequence are called Atlantis. It's in about six parts, more than I have time to read here. Each part, I think, though, is self-contained, and each part has its own title as well. The poem concerns the illness of my partner Wally, who's named here. There are some friends who appear in the poem as well. I think that will be self-explanatory. The first section of this poem is called Reprieve. I woke in the night and thought it was a dream. Nothing has torn the future apart. We have not lived years in dread. It never happened. I dreamed it all. And then there was this sensation of terrific pressure lifting, as if I were rising in one of those old diving bells, lightening, unburdening. I didn't know how heavy my life had become. So much fear, so little knowledge. It was like being young again, but I understood how light I was, how without encumbrance. And so I felt both young and awake, which I never felt when I was young. The curtains moved. It was still summer, all the windows open. And I thought, I can move that easily. I thought my dream had lasted for years, a decade. A dream can seem like that. I thought, there's so much more time. And then, of course, the truth came floating back to me. You know how children love to end stories they tell by saying it was all a dream? Years ago, when I taught kids to write, I used to tell them this ending spoiled things, explaining and dismissing what had come before. Now I know how wise they were to prefer that gesture of closure. Their stories rounded not with a sleep, but a waking. What other gift comes close to a reprieve? This was the dream that Wally told me. I was in the tunnel, he said, and there really was a light at the end, and a great being standing in the light. His arms were full of people, men and women, but his proportions were all just right. I mean, he was the size of you or me. And the people said, come with us, we're going dancing. And they seemed so glad to be going, and so glad to have me join them. But I said, I'm not ready yet. I didn't know what to do when he finished, except hold the relentless weight of him. I didn't know what to say, except it was a dream. Nothing's wrong now. It was only a dream. Michael's dream. Michael writes to tell me his dream. I was helping Randy out of bed, supporting him on one side, with another friend on the other. And as we stood him up, he stepped out of the body I was holding and became a shining body, brilliant light held in the form I first knew him in. This is what I imagine will happen, the spirit's release. Michael, when we support our friends, one of us on either side, our arms under the man or woman's arms, what is it we're holding? Vessel? Shadow? Hurrying light? All those years I made love to a man without thinking how little his body had to do with me. Now, diminished, he's never been so plainly himself. Remote and unguarded, an otherness I can't know the first thing about. I said, you need to drink more water or you're going to turn into an old dry leaf. And he said, maybe I want to be an old leaf. In the dream, Randy's leaping into the future and still here. Michael's holding him and releasing at once. Just as Steve's holding Jerry, though he's already gone. Marie holding John, gone. Maggie holding her John, gone. Carlos and Darren holding another Michael, gone. And I'm holding Wally, who's going. Where isn't the question, though we think it is. We don't even know where the living are, in this rattled and unraveling here. What is the body? Rain on a window? A clear movement over whose gaze? Husk, little boat of paper and wood to to mark the speed of the stream. Randy and Jerry, Michael and Wally and John. Lucky we don't have to know what something is in order to hold it. The last section of this poem is called New Dog. Jimmy and Tony can't keep Dino, their cocker spaniel. Tony's too sick. The daily walk's more pressure than pleasure. One more obligation that can't be met. And though we already have a dog, Wally wants to adopt. Wants something small and golden to sleep next to him and lick his face. He's paralyzed now from the waist down. Whatever's ruining him, moving upward, and we don't know how much longer he'll be able to pet a dog. How many men want another attachment, just as they're leaving the world? Wally sits up nights and says, I'd like some lizards, a talking bird, some fish, a little rat. So after I drive to Jimmy and Tony's in the village, and they meet me at the door and say, we can't go through with it, we can't give up our dog, I drive to the shelter just to look, and there is Bo, bounding and practically boundless, one brass concatenation of tongue and tail, too big, wild, perfect. He not only licks Wally's face, but bathes every irreplaceable inch of his head. And though Wally can no longer feed himself, he can lift his hand and bring it to rest on the rough, gilt flanks when they are, for a moment, still. I have never seen a touch so deliberate. It isn't about grasping. The hand itself seems almost blurred now, softened, though tentative only because so much will must be summoned. Such attention brought to the work, which is all he is now, this gesture toward the restless splendor, the unruly, the golden, the animal, the new. Well, I'm going to end with a poem which wants to think about some of those same questions in a very different way. It's set in a Stop and Shop in Orleans, Massachusetts, which is where I go when I want to do some serious grocery shopping. The place has an extraordinary fish market. The poem is called A Display of Mackerel. They lie in parallel rows, on ice, head to tail, each a foot of luminosity, barred with black bands, which divide the scale's radiant sections, like seams of lead in a Tiffany window. Iridescent, watery prismatics, think abalone, the wildly rainbowed mirror of a soap bubble sphere. Think sun on gasoline. Splendor and splendor. And not a one in any way distinguished from the other. Nothing about them of individuality. Instead, they're all exact expressions of the one soul. Each a perfect fulfillment of heaven's template, mackerel essence. As if, after a lifetime arriving at this enameling, the jewelers made uncountable examples, each as intricate in its oily fabulation as the one before. Suppose we could iridesce like these, and lose ourselves entirely in the universe of shimmer. Would you want to be yourself only, unduplicatable, doomed to be lost? They'd prefer, plainly, to be flashing participants, multitudinous. Even now, they seem to be bolting forward, heedless of stasis. They don't care they're dead and nearly frozen, just as presumably they didn't care that they were living. All for all, the rainbowed school and its acres of brilliant classrooms in which no verb is singular or everyone is. How happy they seem, even on ice, to be together, selfless, which is the price of gleaming. Thank you very much.
Our second reader, fiction writer Stuart Dybeck, is the author of two highly acclaimed collections of short stories, The Coast of Chicago and Childhood and Other Neighborhoods, along with Brass Knuckles, a volume of poems. His work has been widely published in magazines such as The New Yorker, Paris Review, The Atlantic Monthly, Poetry, and others. Among his many honors, he counts fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Guggenheim Foundation, a Whiting Writers Award, and most recently, an Academy Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Currently, he teaches at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. Although Dybeck's stories travel the once familiar world of childhood and often address its restlessness with such still relevant questions as where do I belong and how do I get there, like the transmogrified bird in The Apprentice, built from salvaged hawk, heron, owl, plumes of cock pheasant and peacock, cardinal red, jay blue, they never remain one thing. Yes, we recognize Chicago's L, back alleys with the requisite hulls of rusted out beaters, but like the best Latin American writers, Dybeck is a maker of myths whose stories are informed by ceremonies and visions, prophetic dreams, churches where saints wink and nod. Thus attuned to the resonances from other worlds, his landscape magically shifts, tips into neighborhoods where we may have forgotten we've been or wanted to go. With pleasure, the Poetry Center presents Stuart Dybeck.
Thanks, and thank you, Paulette, for the introduction. It was very tempting to read a story that called Killing Time that was in my last book that basically is set in the men's room of this building, but it's a temptation I overcame. Instead, I'm going to read a story that I hope is a bit of a segue, at least from a very fine poetry reading. It's a story that started off as a poem, and about 3 years I wrestled around with it. I'd always wanted to write one of those poems that goes, is titled something like A Poem on a Line by Wallace Stevens. Of course, once you've seen that, then what you're really writing is a poem on a poem on the line of Wallace Stevens. But anyway, the poet in question here was an Israeli poet named Yehudi Amakai, whose work I really love. And one of the advantages of reading is that I only used three lines from his poem as an epigraph for the story. But I'm going to read you the whole poem, which is very short anyway. And the story then kind of plays little games with this poem. It's called We Did It. We did it in front of the mirror and in the light. We did it in darkness, in water, and in the high grass. We did it in honor of man and in honor of beast and in honor of God. But they didn't want to know about us. They'd already seen our sort. We did it with imagination and colors, with confusion of reddish hair and brown, and with difficult, gladdening exercises. We did it like wheels and holy creatures, and with chariot feats of prophets. We did it six wings and six legs, but the heavens were hard above us, like the earth of summer beneath. We didn't. We didn't in the light. We didn't in darkness. We didn't in the fresh cut summer grass or in the mounds of autumn leaves or on the snow where moonlight threw down our shadows. We didn't in your room on the canopy bed you slept in, the bed you'd slept in as a child, or in the back seat of my father's rusted Rambler which smelled of the smoked chubs and kielbasa that he delivered on weekends from my Uncle Vincent's meat market. We didn't in your mother's Buick 8, where a rosary twined the rear-view mirror like a beaded black snake with silver cruciform fangs. At the dead end of our lover's lane, a side street of abandoned factories, where I perfected the pinch that springs open a bra. Behind the lilac bushes in Marquette Park, where you first touched me through my jeans, and your nipples swollen against transparent cotton seemed the shade of lilacs. In the balcony of the now defunct Clark Theater, where I wiped popcorn salt from my palms and slid them up to your thighs, and you whispered, I feel like Doris Day is watching us. We didn't. How adept we were at fumbling, how perfectly mistimed our timing, how utterly we confused energy with ecstasy. Remember that night becalmed by heat and the two of us fused by sweat, trembling as if a wind from outer space that only we could feel was gusting across Oak Street Beach. Wound in your faded Navajo blanket, we lay soul-kissing until you wept with wanting. We'd been kissing all day, all summer, kisses tasting of different shades of lip gloss and too many Cokes. The lake had turned hot pink, rose rapture, pearl amethyst with dusk, then washed in night black with a ruff of silver foam. Beyond a momentary horizon, silent bolts of heat lightning throbbed, perhaps setting barns on fire somewhere in Indiana. The beach that had been so crowded was deserted as if there was a curfew. Only the bodies of lovers remained behind, visible in lightning flashes, scattered like the fallen on a battlefield, a few of them moaning, waiting for the gulls to pick them clean. On my fingers, your slick scent mixed with the coconut musk of the suntan lotion we'd repeatedly smeared over one another's bodies. When your bikini top fell away, my hands caught your breasts, memorizing their delicate weight, my palms cupped as if bringing water to parched lips. Along the Gold Coast, high-rises began to glow, window added to window against the dark. In every lighted bedroom, couples home from work were stripping off their business suits, falling to the bed and doing it. They did it before mirrors and pressed against the glass in streaming shower stalls. They did it against walls and on the furniture in ways that required previously unimagined gymnastics, which they invented on the spot. They did it in honor of man and woman, in honor of beast, in honor of God. They did it because they'd been released, because they were home free, alive, and private, because they couldn't wait any longer, couldn't wait for the appointed hour, for the right time or temperature, couldn't wait for the future, for messiahs, for peace on earth and justice for all. They did it because of the bomb, because of pollution, because of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, because extinction might be just a blink away. They did it because it was Friday night. It was Friday night. And somewhere delirious music was playing, flutter-tongued flutes, muted tomcats meowing, muted trumpets meowing like tomcats in heat, feverish plunkings and twangings, tom-toms, congas and gongs all pounding the same pulse beat. I stripped the bikini bottom down the skinny rails of your legs, and you tugged my swimsuit past my tan. Swimsuits at our ankles, we kicked like swimmers to free our legs, almost expecting a tide to wash over us, the way the tide rushes in on Burt Lancaster and Deborah Kerr in their famous love scene on the beach and From Here to Eternity. A scene so famous that although neither of us had seen the movies, our bodies assumed the exact position of movie stars on the sand, and you whispered to me softly, "I'm afraid of getting pregnant." And I whispered back, "Don't worry, I have protection." Then still kissing, you felt for my discarded cutoffs and the wallet in which for the last several months I had carried a Trojan as if it was a talisman. Still kissing, I tore its flattened, dried-out wrapper, and it sprang through my fingers like a spring from a clock and dropped to the sand between our legs. My hands were shaking. In a panic, I groped for it, found it, tried to dust it off, tried as Burt Lancaster never had to slip it on without breaking the mood, felt the grains of sand inside it, a throb of lightning, and the great lake behind us became, for all practical purposes, the Pacific, and your skin tasted of salt, and to the insistent question that my hips were asking, your body answered yes, your thighs opened like wings from my waist as we surfaced, panning from a kiss that left you pleading, "Oh Christ, yes," a yes gasp so sharply as a cry of pain, so that for a moment I thought that we were already doing it, and that somehow I had missed the instant when I entered you in the bloodless way in which a young man discards his own virginity, entered you as if passing through a gateway into the rest of my life, into a life as I wanted it to be lived, yes. But oh, then I realized we were still floundering unconnected in the slick between us, and there was sand in the Trojan as we slammed together, still feeling for that perfect fit, still in the here groping for an eternity that was only a fine adjustment away, just a millimeter to the left or a fraction of an inch further south, though with all the adjusting, the sandy Trojan was slipping off, and then it was gone, but you kept repeating yes, although your head was shaking, no, not quite, almost, and our hearts were going like mad, and you said, "Yes, yes, wait, stop." "What?" I asked, still futilely thrusting as if I hadn't quite heard you. "Oh God," you gasped, pushing yourself up, "what's coming?" "Julie, what's the matter?" I asked, confused. And then the beam of a spotlight swept over us, and I glanced into its blinding eye. All around us, lights were coming, speeding across the sand. Blinking blindness away, I rolled from your body to my knees, feeling utterly defenseless in the way that only nakedness can leave one feeling. Headlights bounded toward us, spotlights crisscrossing, blue dome lights revolving as squad cars converged. I could see other lovers caught in the beams, fleeing bare-assed through the litter of garbage that daytime hordes had left behind and that night had deceptively concealed. You were crying, clutching the Navajo blanket to your breasts with one hand and clawing for your bikini with the other, and I was trying to calm your terror with reassuring phrases such as, "Holy shit, I don't fucking believe this." Swerving and fishtailing in the sand, police calls pouring from their radios, the squad cars were on us, and then they were by us while we sat struggling on our clothes. They braked at the water's edge, and cops slammed out brandishing huge flashlights, their beams deflecting over the dark water. Beyond the darting of those beams, the far-off throbs of lightning seemed faint by comparison. "Over there, goddammit," one of them hollered, and two cops slashed down into the shallow water without even pausing to kick off their shoes, huffing aloud for breath, their leather cartridge belts creaking against their bellies. We would always kid about going there. "Are you in the mood for a little dong tonight?" I'd ask. It was a dopey joke, and you'd break up at its repeated dopiness. Back then in winter, if one of us ordered the garlic shrimp, we would both be sure to eat them so that later our mouths tasted the same when we kissed. Even when she wasn't mentioned, she was there with her drowned body so dumpy next to yours, and her sad breasts with their wrinkled nipples and sour milk, so saggy besides yours, which were still budding, with her swollen body, her belly and her pubic bush colorless in the glare of electric light, with her tangled, slimy hair and her pouting, placid face so lifeless beside yours, and her skin a pallid white, lightning flash white, flashbulb white, a whiteness that couldn't be duplicated in daylight, how I come to hate that pallor so cold beside the flush of your skin. There wasn't a particular night when we finally broke up, just as there wasn't a particular night when we began going together. But I do remember a night in fall when I guessed that it was over. We were parked in the Rambler at the dead end of the street of factories that had been our lover's lane, listening to a drizzle of rain and dry leaves sprinkled the hood. As always, rain revitalized the smells of the smoked fish and kielbasa in the upholstery. The radio was on too low to hear. The windshield wipers swished at intervals as if we were driving, and the windows were steamed as if we'd been making out. But we'd been arguing, as usual, this time about a woman poet who had committed suicide, whose work you were reading. We were sitting no longer talking or touching, and I remember thinking that I didn't want to argue with you anymore. I didn't want to sit here like this in silence. I wanted to talk excitedly all night, as we once had. I wanted to find some way that wasn't corny sounding to tell you how much fun I'd had in your company, how much knowing you had meant to me, and how I had suddenly realized that I'd been so intent on becoming lovers that I'd overlooked how close we'd been as friends. I wanted you to know that. I wanted you to like me again. It's sad, I started to say, meaning that I was sorry we had reached the point of sitting silently together, but before I could continue, you challenged the statement. What makes you so sure it's sad? What do you mean, what makes me so sure, I asked, confused by your question and surprised there could be anything to argue over no matter what you thought I was talking about. You looked at me as if what was sad was that I would never understand. For all either one of us knows, you said, she could have been triumphant. Maybe when it really ended was that night when I felt we had just reached the beginning. That one time on the beach in summer between high school and college, when our bodies rammed together so desperately that for a moment I thought we did it. Maybe in our hearts we had, although for me then, doing it in one's heart didn't quite count. If it did, I supposed we'd all be Casanovas. I remember riding home together on the L that night, feeling sick and defeated in a way I was embarrassed to mention. Our mute reflections emerged like negative exposures on the dark, greasy window of the train. Lightning branched over the city, and when the train entered the subway tunnel, the lights inside flickered as if the power was disrupted, although the train continued rocketing beneath the loop. When the train emerged again, we were on the south side of the city and it was pouring, a deluge as if the sky had opened to drown the innocent and guilty alike. We hurried from the L station to your house, holding the Navajo blanket over our heads until soaked, it collapsed. In the dripping doorway of your apartment building, we said goodnight. You were shivering. Your bra showed through the thin blouse plastered to your skin. I swept the wet hair away from your face and kissed you lightly on the lips. Then you turned and went inside, and I stepped into the rain, and you came back out calling after me. What, I asked, feeling a surge of gladness to be summoned back into the doorway with you. Want an umbrella? I didn't. The downpour was letting up. It felt better to walk back to the L, feeling the rain rinse the sand out of my hair, off my legs, until the only places where I could still feel its grit was the crotch of my cutoffs and in each squish of my shoes. A block down the street, I passed a pair of jockey shorts lying in a puddle and realized they were mine, dropped from my back pocket as we ran to your house. I left them behind, wondering if you'd see them and recognize them the next day. By the time I had climbed the stairs back to the L platform, the rain had stopped. Your scent still hadn't washed from my fingers. The station, the entire city, it seemed, dripped and steamed. The summer sound of crickets and nighthawks echoed from the drenched neighborhood. Alone, I could admit how sick I felt. For you, it was a night that would haunt your dreams. For me, it was another night when I waited, swollen and aching, for what I had secretly nicknamed the Blue Ball Express. Literally lovesick, groaning inwardly with each lurch of the train and worried that I was damaged for good, I peered out at the passing yellow-lit stations where lonely men stood posted before giant advertisements, pictures of glamorous models defaced by graffiti, the same old scrawled insults and pleas, fuck you, eat me. At this late hour, the world seemed given over to men without women. Men waiting in abject patience for something indeterminate, the way I waited for our next times. I avoided their eyes so that they wouldn't see the pity in mine. Pity for them because I'd just been with you. Your scent was still on my hands, and there seemed to be so much future still ahead. For me, it was another night like that. By the time I reached my stop, I knew I would be feeling better. Recovered enough to walk the dark street home, making up poems of longing that I never wrote down. I was the D.H. Lawrence of not doing it. The voice of all the would-be lovers who ached and squirmed but still hadn't. From our contortions in doorways, on stairwells, on the bucket seats of cars, we could have composed the Kara Sutra of interrupted bliss. It must have been a night like that when I recalled all the other times of walking home after seeing you, so that it seemed as if I was falling into step behind the parade of my former selves. Myself walking home on the night we first kissed. Myself on the night when I unbuttoned your blouse and kissed your breasts. Myself on the night that I lifted your skirt above your thighs and dropped to my knees. Each succeeding self another step closer to that irrevocable moment for which our lives seemed poised. But we didn't. Not in the moonlight or by the phosphorescent lanterns of lightning bugs in your backyard. Not beneath the constellations that we couldn't see, let alone decipher. Or in the dark glow that had replaced the real darkness of night, a darkness already stolen from us. Not with the skyline rising behind us while the city gradually decayed. Not in the heat of summer while a cold war raged. Despite the freedom of youth and the license of first love. Because of fate, karma, luck, what does it matter? We made not doing it a wonder. And yet we didn't. We didn't. We never did.